Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. We're back. I just moved to my hometown, and that we're still in the process of bringing stuff over from the old house, which kind of sucks, but there we are. But we're unpacking, we're getting settled in, and moving with four young kids is not super fun. So, but we're getting it done. I just got internet installed today, so I'm glad glad that happened. Otherwise, I'd be working off the hotspot on my phone, and don't know how well that would work. So, and today I have a very fun guest. You probably know him on Twitter as Conan Esquire. He tweets a lot about fantasy fiction and and storytelling in general. What makes a good story? How it works? And he's written essays on boys' adventure fiction and Conan the Barbarian, and we'll get to all of that. And he's got a series called The Ashes of the Urn. It's two books out, The Turquoise Serpent and The Flowers of the Moon. I almost got that wrong. Alexander Palacio, thank you for joining the show.
Hey, my pleasure, Aaron. My pleasure. I'm really glad we could connect. I'm honored to be talking to you on the first day of internet access after the move. I know how chaotic moving can be. So thanks for making the time. I really appreciate it.
I really like doing this. So this is kind of like, I don't have to unpack right now, you know, single night this week out to like midnight, you know, or later, we've been just putting stuff away, getting stuff in the house, you know, just working ourselves to death. And this is like, I don't have to do that tonight. So that's really nice. I mean, I did kind of a little bit before we started, but yeah, so this is like a break. So
I'm on Twitter as Conan Esquire. Obviously my books come with the name Alexander Palacio on them. So you can go with whichever one you choose. I post about all that stuff. I try to post about law here and there. I'm also an attorney. That's the source of the Esquire in the handle. It's so boring though, right? Like the deeper you go into law posting, maybe I think the more interesting it gets from an internal perspective, but the more stultifying and dry it gets when you try to share that interest with anyone else, right? Like if you just talk about law at the most surface possible level, you can tell people some fun stories, right? Some crazy tales about like what so-and-so said about another person that got them fired,
right?
Or, you know, what's the craziest thing you ever saw another lawyer do in court. But when you start talking about, you know, how crazy this specific detail of Canadian employment law and its, you know, its specific context of enforcement in Ontario or something like that, people's eyes start to glaze over. So I always tell people, like, you know, if you want to go to law school, like, A, it's not suits. It's not going to be as cool as you think it is. That cachet is all gone. And B, if you don't listen to me and you do it anyway, and you go to a bar and you want to flex and impress people, say you're a lawyer. And if they ask, oh, cool, what do you do? What kind of law do you practice? Just stop there. Just move on. Like, change the topic. You won't get any more cool points for going past just saying that you're a lawyer. Like, that's the best you can do, right? That first statement, that's the best. It's all downhill from there.
Right. Yeah. The more you talk, the less cool you get, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's why I mostly spend my time posting about science fiction and fantasy, speculative fiction, storytelling, you know, just general observational stuff, conspiracy content. I really like conspiracy stuff.
Yeah, that's
fun. I've also written couple of essays about that. And the best for me, the best is when I can merge them together, right? Like the threads and essays that I wrote on Lord of the Rings, talking about the conspiracies within Lord of the Rings. So that's kind of a little bit about me, I guess. I think more or less, you know, everybody who knows my account would already know all that, but maybe it's interesting to see how I perceive myself, right? That's, I don't know, that's always interesting. when I see how other people talk about themselves and perceive themselves. So throwing it out there for interest.
Right. Yeah, I like the way you, I remember that Twitter thread you had about, I think it was how Gandalf was conspiring to get Aragorn to the throne and everything. And everything within the Lord of the Rings story kind of like is this, I don't like this conspiratorial plot, you know, to get him not in like a sinister way, you know, like they had to maneuver right around Sauron, you know, so there has to be like, it's kind of like a Eucatastro conspiracy or something, you know, like, and so yeah, really interesting. And how everything everything Gandalf did was kind of geared toward getting Aragorn to the throne. So that was, yeah, that was an interesting thread. And like whenever you have something like that, you always get like so much engagement too. It's crazy. Like you just, and all these people come out of the work to like go after you or tell you you're stupid or whatever, you know. And it's just kind of insane. Where do these people come from? I don't. It's like
I don't know. Like there's a good set of people. Like if I post a thread like that that starts to get a little heat on it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like a set of people. There's a roster of people I know who may or may not agree with whatever I'm posting, mm-hmm. but they'll give like kind of interesting feedback or criticism or whatever. And then after that, like around the 500 like mark, it kind of breaks containment. And yeah. I start to get like lunatic comments just like from unhinged people who don't know me and, you know, have no idea what I'm about, but make a bunch of wild assumptions and don't know anything about the topic of the thread either. In fact, a lot of times they're criticisms are like directly anticipated and responded to in the thread, so I just know that they didn't even read it or didn't comprehend it if they did. So I usually just laugh at it. Sometimes it bugs me. Like sometimes it's just like too much. I have to turn the phone off because it's like too overwhelming. Because I'm like, you guys are all so dumb. But that's the way you think. You know, you can't spend time in that mental space.
I remember this one poet. She posted, her name is Jane. I forget her last name, but she's a, not Jane Charles, who's been on the show, a different Jane. And she was kind of critiquing, not so really critiquing, just kind of lampooning, what's it called? It's like this, it's not even a form of poetry, but you take like an existing poem and you like black out a lot of the letters. And then you like make something out of that, you know, where it's like you make a stupid message out of, you basically like vandalize a poem to make a stupid point. And she said that that's not real poetry, you know, and like so many people, just people with in their bios on Twitter will have like, I'm autistic, you know, or something like, I'm literally like,
I gay mentally ill queer Marxist.
Like just people, and they to almost a person, to almost an account, they all had something like that in their bio, and they were all just like going after this person. And I'm like, well, she's clearly right. Like that's not poetry. That's just stupid. Like it might be funny, but it's not like a work of art. And they're like, oh yes, it is. How could you know? It's whenever you talk about like art. And what makes something art, and what makes a poem, and what makes this, you know, when you actually start putting down like hard and fast rules, people just lose their minds, especially when it comes to art. I don't know what it is. Like it's crazy. All the lunatics come out. But
yeah, one of the points that it's not one of the worst kind of levels of pushback that I get when I post about stuff, but there's often a sort of tension around posting some of my kind of like theories or approaches to writing or writing advice when I tell people that if you, you know, let me back up a little bit and say that for a long time, there has been in the sort of indie writing community and indie writing advice giving community, right? Forums, blogs about writing, YouTube channels, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's a specious and silly, like dichotomy between like two, they all see it as like two groups of writers, right? There's the pantsers who just write as they go and like make it up as they go along and figure it out. And the plotters who outline everything in advance and have a much more type A rigorous approach to it. And I think that I don't like the dichotomy in the first place. I think it's pretty dumb.
Yeah.
But I also think that the pantsers have a certain like moral advantage in the current, you know, just like moral landscape, or because anytime that a plotter advocates for their own more structured, more rule-based approach to writing, the pantsers get very upset, right, and say, right. Oh no, you know, you could just let people enjoy things, like touch some grass, and that, you know, that doesn't work for everyone, blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, maybe I'm biased because I'm like very much, I do a lot of structured work. I do a lot of outlining. It's a central important part of my process.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not, I won't call myself a plotter either, because to me, the whole thing is specious. If you make an outline and then you write, and if you think of something better while you're writing, you just use that. Like,
right. Yeah.
The outline doesn't control, you don't have to write what's in the outline.
Right.
But you could change the outline. It's not that big of a deal.
Right.
And furthermore, my advice is always, always couched and qualified and caveated to say that if your process is not working for you, right? If your writing process is not working for you, if you're not seeing the kind of output that you'd like to see, if you're struggling to get projects across the finish line, whether that's a short story, whether that's a full-length novel, whatever it is, look at your process, right? Like, don't let your hidebound adherence to this idea of the process that you have stop you from finishing projects that you want to finish. And a lot of the time I ask people, and I'm like, how structured is your writing? Like, do you ever look at story structure resources? Have you ever tried to learn anything about, you know, any theories about how to structure a story? Have you ever tried to put yours, like, have you ever really done the work of trying to make an outline of your story so that you can see what your scene consists of, right? How long is that scene going to be in terms of word count? What's the turning point of that scene? What characters are in that scene? What are each of those characters' goals and intentions within that scene that's going to move the story forward in a, you know, in a way that is gripping and interesting to the audience or to the reader? And very, very often people are like, no, I've never done any of that. Of course, I just sit right. down and I, you know, I have a blank page in front of me and I'm trying to like think of a whole story in my head at one time and you get stuck, or, you know, it just doesn't, you know, the pacing is wrong, or you write yourself into corners that you don't know how to get out of, or blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And you can fix that, of course. Like, if you just have all the time in the world, or you're particularly talented in that direction, maybe you have an intuitive grasp of story structure that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be able to put into words or put into an outline, but you know, you follow stories all your life, so you just have a good intuitive grasp of it.
Right.
And you can create a pretty good approximation of it, like freehand. Great. You have the time to do that. You have the time to get it all out. You have the time to go revise it. You have the time to rewrite large sections of it if you need to. Great. You know, do it that way. Stephen King did it that way. A lot of writers have done it that way. I can't do it. I don't have the time to do it that way. You know what I mean? If I, you know, I'm writing a 60,000 page novel right now, book three of the Ashes of the Urn series.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get it out in the fall. I'm trying to bang my way through it right now, and then I have to revise the whole thing, get the cover done, blah, 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 put it out. And if I write 60,000 words and I have to scrap 10,000 of those words and rewrite them or significantly change the structure of the story, like that's backbreaking to me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I have to find the 15 minutes in a day, the 20 minutes in a day that I can just sit down and rip through words, as many words as I can in those 15 or 20 minutes, between, you know, my obligations to my family, my obligations to my job, just living a busy life, right? Like, I have also other, you know, I gotta go to the gym, I gotta you know, fix the air conditioning in the garage, like all this house crap.
Yep.
So it's just, there's a lot going on, you know.
Yep. Well, I know.
And
yeah.
So, you know, if I'm Ursula Le Guin or somebody, like a professional author or whoever who has just like a life that's designed around a professional writing career it allows her to, you know, if you ever look at her schedule or whatever, she has this like beautifully leisurely writing schedule where she like writes in the morning and has a pleasant lunch with her cat and then reads her words back to her husband and like all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, great. Like, great. Cool. Right on. I can't do that. So I can't like be rewriting, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to be a little bit more precise and targeted. And I think that really helps, like kind of having that project completion mindset. It is necessary. And the structure really enables that for people who aren't really used to it.
Right.
But if I post, you know, I get a lot of good feedback from that. When I post about it on Twitter, a lot of people are like, wow, I never really thought about this. I never really realized that you could just learn that, right? Or take that approach to where you are really kind of breaking down a project into its constituent parts and then hitting those parts in a sequential order that's going to lead to a finished product.
Mm-hmm.
But then I get a lot of people who are really upset about it, right?
Right.
Like, yep. You're sucking the life out of it, or let people enjoy things. Blah,
they
blah,
have this like heavily romanticized notion of writing, you know, I think a lot of the time where it's like, well, I'm a writer, you know, I, you know, like they want the Ursula Le Guin lifestyle, but really they're the, you know, what they have to do is the Robert E. Howard lifestyle, you know, when that, hopefully not how that ended, you know, like, cause he committed suicide, but,
so true.
But it reminds me of like, so comparing like Ursula Le Guin to Gene Wolfe, who didn't start writing until he was in his 40s, you know, and probably I'm guessing is because he had children. And he had a full-time job, you know, at Procter & Gamble as an engineer. And he started writing when he was in his 40s. And I'm just wondering if that's, you know, it's probably why. He had kids and he had to support a family. And when everyone was grown, you know, he could pursue writing, you know, as a career. And I think that's, you know, if I ever wanted to start writing, which I have some inclination to do so, but then I have some time. You know, Gene Wolfe didn't start till he was in his 40s. So I think I'm all right. But
that's pretty true of a lot of people. If I remember correctly, I don't think Jack Vance really did much serious writing until later in life as well.
Well, it's the same with like Ari Lafferty too. Like he didn't start writing until he was in his late 40s, I think. And they're all like amazing writers. So it's not like you have to be.
Yeah, those are like three of my favorite in the genre.
No kidding. And and having little kids is really. And trying to be a writer is really hard. I mean, I'm not a writer, but just finding any time to do anything like for that sort of, you know, creative pursuit when you have little kids running around is challenging. So going towards your books, I mean, you're working on the third one now, and the first two are out. And just kind of tell us about the series, and kind of it's in a subgenre called sword and sorcery, which is kind of like Robert E. Howard pioneered that and kind of pretty much invented it. And you just kind of tell us about your series, where it takes place, and the major characters and all that stuff.
Yeah, the series, The Ashes of the Urn, it takes place in a totally fictional setting that's loosely derived from pre-Columbian Mesoamerican cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the idea with the whole thing, at least to start with. It's very Aztec and Mayan themed.
Yeah.
But as the series continues, and the idea is to kind of continue it on an ongoing basis, as long as I have fun ideas that I think will fit in that series and with those characters, it's going to be more or less an episodic running series that, you know, it'll go as long as there's interest and as long as, you know, there's interest on both sides, right? Like interest from me and interest from an audience.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of the Howard influence comes in, right? Like a lot of the Robert Howard stuff, and as well as a lot of the people who kind of wrote in his wake, were not really concerned with like an overarching Conan story. Of course, there's the arc of him sort of rising to prominence and becoming king of Aquilonia, and then, you know, subsequently abdicating the throne to go back on further adventures. And that's like the loosest possible over plot, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. there's not that much to it. There's no, you know, grand finale or final destiny or chosen one element to it or anything.
Right.
And so that's kind of what we're doing here. You know, these two individuals, one a renowned warrior who's kind of older and one a young and arrogant wizard, are forced together by circumstances and both become sort of exiled from their place of origin and are forced into the, you know, tumble from adventure to adventure. And that's what we're doing. And I think in the next book, we're kind of going beyond the original boundaries of Aztec Mayan influence, right? And now we're going to start branching out into, I think, other kind of pre-Columbian American cultural influences and probably get weirder than that, right? Like, the idea was to keep the first one relatively grounded and not totally familiar cultural imagery, mm-hmm. but you know, if you see the wooden sword and the sandals and whatever, you're like, okay, I get it. It's like Aztec stuff.
Right.
Right. A jaguar skin or something like that. But it's kind of fresh because there's just not a lot, like it's not the Aztec stuff and the Mayan stuff doesn't really saturate media, especially fantasy fiction.
Yeah. That was it's unique.
Other influences do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's recognizable still, I think, to people broadly. But I think once we're kind of settled in the world, I think I have a little bit more license to, you know, explore a little bit more, bring in some other stuff, get a little crazier, remix things in a kind of more sui generis milieu or context than just sticking to, you know, here's the Aztec one, here's the Mayan one, here's the Inca one, here's the whatever. Because that's not really what I want to do. I don't want it to be that one-to-one.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
because part of what draws me to fantasy is I like that extremity of ideas like that, when things get really kind of unfamiliar and weird. In terms of like the kind of trappings of the story, because you know, in a sense, like every story is fantasy or science fiction. Mm-hmm. They're the same thing, really. But every story is fantasy, right? Because it didn't happen. Unless right. we're reading a history book or something. So, you know, even if I'm reading a story like that's intensely grounded in the real world, like the first one that pops to mind is like some of the stuff that Jonathan Safran Foer wrote about New York City, or Philip Marlowe.
Yeah.
Noir novels in LA, that kind of thing. Those are super grounded in real places, real streets, real, you know, real, they're pulling real character from the location. But at the same time, it's still a fantasy, right? It didn't happen. It could never happen. It's a creation.
Right.
And so if I'm, that's all great, but it, like, at the same time, I like to push that. I like to see where that can go. I like to, when I'm reading, I like to read, like, you know, we were listing the names, right? Gene Wolfe really pushes it.
Oh, yeah.
It's part of the game is trying to identify where the heck he got any of these ideas. Like, you know, one of the big ones in Book of the New Sun, which is his work that I'm most familiar with, is, I can't remember the name of the people in the North that... Oh. The Empire is fighting against
this. Oh no! Yeah,
they're like the communists.
Yeah, yeah. They're in the thrall of these like Lovecraftian sort of mm-hmm. horrors, right. You know, from beyond the moon or whatever.
Right.
And they're they're like they only talk in these like kind of canned phrases, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you can kind of see like where he's pulling a few of those ideas from and recombining them. And then Jack Vance, of course, does the same thing. Like if you ever read obviously his Kudrel series, like Eyes of the Overworld or Kudrel Saga or Rialto, he just gets in these like bizarre and fantastic circumstances that are so creative and have their own, each little arc has its own fascinating ecosystem mechanisms that affect how, you know, affect the course of Kujel's journey and force him to respond to them. And I love that. Like, there's one, you know, Eyes of the Overworld, the perfect example right off the bat. He gets transported far to the north, where he is given the task as punishment for trying to steal from Yukanu the wizard. He's given the task of stealing two, like, contact lenses from this village in the far north of the world. And these contact lenses let you see into, like, a higher dimension, right? So you are experiencing this higher dimension where everything is beautiful and you have, you know, everything you want and all the delicious food and pleasurable company and palaces and so forth. But in reality, or at least in this dimension, you're in a disgusting village in the far north. Like, everybody's fat and ugly and falling apart and eating nasty smoked fish and acting like they're these, like, refined lords and ladies, because that's their experience and that they're seeing through the eyes of the overworld. Yeah. They're seeing that into the overworld. And so, you know, Kujel has to, like, work within the boundaries of that mechanism to figure out how to get those lenses and get them back to Yukanu, and the story continues from there. And then Lafferty, of course, too, has, like, some of the zaniest stuff, I think, maybe out of all three of them. Mm-hmm. I'm not as familiar with Lafferty, I think, as you are, but I know I read Past Master by him.
Where, yeah, like, that's amazing.
They get Thomas Ward back, and that's a crazy one. And then I also read one, it was like Reefs of Earth, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was like a weird, like, almost Ray Bradbury type story where these, like, alien kids came to Earth and were having, like, you know, early Americana adventures, and you slowly realize that they're, like, some kind of alien species.
Right. And they're trying to kill everybody. And they're not very good at it.
That's kind of all in their heads.
Right.
It was great. It was really charming.
Yeah. And
it's just so weird and alien that I was like, this is what I want to do, right?
Well, going with that, Jack Vance, so Lafferty does have a story that's very similar to that, where he, I forget what it's called, but, you know, maybe Gregorio Monteo, if he listens to this, he'll send me a message, but, the scientist invents this machine where you can see from another person's perspective, you know, and it's, you know, some people, if they're, like, a materialist, you know, everything will be, like, globular, you know, or is, you know, like, how their own philosophy and how their own bodies, like women see the world differently than men, you know, and, like, the one woman who, like, he sees through her eyes, this guy is disgusted because everything is so sensuous, you know, like, everything is, like, so intensely sensuous. That he just is like, it's disgusting, you know? And she's like, well, you're just in, you know, and so, and she sees through his eyes and he's like, everything is just, you know, abstract and, or, you know, whatever, you know? So it's very, very interesting. And it's, that reminds me of, like, what Tolkien said, in On Fairy Stories, like, that what makes a good fantasy story is, like, the arresting strangeness, you know? Where it's like this weirdness in the story that makes you stop, you know? And yeah, and Tim Powers does that really well. Gene Wolfe does; he's a master at it, you know. And Lafferty is like, that's all he does.
Right. His stories are just weird. I just read my first Tim Powers book recently on Stranger Tides.
Yeah, yeah.
People have been telling me to read it for a while, and I finally pulled the trigger. I saw it at the bookstore, and I was like, I'm blown away. It was really great. I think I posted about it, like, 20 pages in or something.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
I feel like I'm in good hands, you know. I'm excited.
Yeah,
here.
He's great. Yeah, Powers, he's my favorite writer. I mean, he's like more accessible than Wolf, he's tricky too, because he'll after my second read through of the Anubis Gates, you know, I noticed all of these, like, liturgical things that he was doing with, like, the Catholic,
I have that one.
Yeah, with, like, the Catholic liturgical calendar. Like, pay attention, favorite, like, whenever Powers, like, has dates or if something weird happens, you know, like, you have to know your liturgy. You know, you have to know what's going on that date. you know, in the liturgy.
Interesting.
Because he'll...
Tolkien's kind of like that too.
What was that?
Tolkien's kind of like that too, yeah. Specifically with the dates.
Yep.
Right? Because a lot of those dates line up.
Well, Wolf does it too. Wolf is more explicit about it. But Powers is very tricky. Like he's... You think he's just this adventure writer, but there's a lot of depth to him, and I didn't even know that until I read the Anubis Gates again, and I'm like, holy crap, this is like a literary masterpiece. Like, this is really an impressive book. With your series, it's set in this like Mesoamerican culture. You have warriors with iron swords and obsidian blades, and you have like human sacrifice, you know, and giant snakes. But the dedication page, this is very interesting. I was reading through, flipping through the first book again, and I noticed the dedication page, and it said, "For the boys." So what does that mean, for the boys?
Well, it's layered. You know what I mean? I put a lot of thought into that. I thought it was clever. On the one hand, it's like, for my homies on Twitter, right?
That's
writing to that audience. And I like that's really why I started even conceiving of the idea to actually self-publish the stuff that I was like messing around with and writing and thinking about, because I've done it for a long time just to amuse myself and to, I don't know, just to do it. I like it. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
But when I, you know, when I got on Twitter and was making friends and getting followers and stuff like that, I was like, yeah, you know, people heard, like, you know, I would be talking about writing stuff or posting about writing stuff, and people would be like, "Oh, do you write?" Yeah, I write, I guess. Yo, I want to read it. So, I would send short stories out or that kind of thing.
And
they were like, you should write something and just publish it. Like, just put it on Amazon. It's easy. And, you know, that was my hang up. My hang up was like, I thought there was like more process involved in putting it on Amazon, but and there is, like, there is if you want to do it right, like if you really want to be super branded and try to make your money off doing that, but that's never really been like my main interest. Like, if you guys want to make me rich, listen, if you want to make me rich, do it. I dare you.
Yeah, me too.
Go for it. I won't say no.
Right. I don't have any books, but just give me some money, that'd be great.
I really did just like do it for the love. And so that's, you know, that's why I made the dedication that, but also because it's like one of the things that I talk about a lot, and one of the things that I think is really missing from sort of our cultural portfolio, so to speak, in the modern era, is writing that is written, like adventure writing that's written to boys that used to exist, that just doesn't really exist, at least in anywhere like, you know, the with the publicity and numbers that it used to, like, I've written a whole essay on this, actually. I think I published it with IM 1776 magazine, but it's called a Lost History of Adventure, or a History of Lost Adventure or something.
Yep.
But the basic thesis is like, if you just look at the sales numbers, right, for some of the classic like young men's boys adventure novels, like Her by H. Rider Haggard, or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne, which is not like, it's not a sci-fi novel. You know what I mean? People talk about Verne as like a sci-fi guy, and it's fair to some extent, but he exists before that genre delineation is really firm in any way. And the Nemo character, like Nemo's, all that is very like adventure novel from that era, right? Like similarly, I'm blanking now. I totally need to look at my own essay.
I think Robert Louis Stevenson featured heavily in that essay.
Yeah, I was talking about Stevenson. I was talking about bestsellers, because Stevenson and Haggard are like selling insane numbers. Like, if you would look at the top selling books of all time, like the top 50, their books are like, they have a couple books each in that top list of like all-time bestsellers.
Right.
So, and there's other people writing like that too, like James Hilton's writing Lost Horizon, Harold Lamb's writing Jack London stuff. you know, Seawolf is my personal favorite, but I know Call of the Wild is like outsold it by a million miles. All those guys, Raphael Sabatini,
yep.
Erskine Childers, Anthony Hope, they're all writing to the same like young man adventure market, and they're crushing it. And they're not only crushing it in sales, they're crushing it in cultural impact, right? Because Freud and Jung are referencing Haggard in their like psychoanalytic writing.
Yeah, right.
Their academic writing. Who's talking about Haggard in Haggard's influence in their own careers? It's Rudyard Kipling. It's Tolkien. It's Graham yep. Greene. It's Henry Miller. You know what I mean? It's Arthur Conan Doyle. Even Howard, Robert Howard.
Right.
Everybody is kind of swimming in that wake because of that cultural impact. And Haggard's not even the only guy. You know, there's like all these people writing to this market that is pretty much vanished now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think the last thing that you could really consider a successful, you know, essay at this market is the Sharp series. That series about like the Napoleonic War.
Mm.
But you know, but it's selling substantially. It's like selling a lot of books, but nothing like the volume, the sheer volume and size of the market as it used to be. And I think you just missed out on a lot with, you know, that gap. You know, who's writing to that anymore? It doesn't exist. It's like been supplanted for whatever reason by, not reading. Basically, you know what I mean? It's been supplanted by video games.
Right. Yeah. No.
But that it's, even if it has, even if people want to watch movies or they want to watch video games, like books are still sort of, where a lot of those ideas come from, especially for movies. But even for video games, like a lot of the ideas that make it into video games are not, or even if the IP itself is original in a video game, a lot of the ideas that inform the IP in the video game are being developed and being experimented with in novels before yeah. they get into the video game. You know what I mean? Like
right.
Cyberpunk 2077, right? It's an original IP, sort of, but it doesn't exist without Neuromancer
mm-hmm.
at all. You know what I mean? Even if Neuromancer comes up. So there is, even if it's not a direct influence, I still think that the literary market has actually a lot of cultural influence because of the way that, just because of the form, right? The form, that novel long form, I think is still one of the better ways to kind of develop an idea in its early stages. And then once it's refined, it can be refined into film, it can be refined into video games, television, whatever. And so that's what, you know, when you're not writing those boys' adventures novels or young men's adventure novels, of course it's not, you know, people are saying like, where are the swashbuckler movies now, right? How come Pirates of the Caribbean was the last good swashbuckling movie?
Right.
Because they stopped writing the books, you know, like that's...
Well, and that's ironic you mention that, because like on Stranger Tides, that Powers novel... they finally had to pay him the rights to the title, you know, of the book, because the fourth movie is on Stranger Tides. But
right.
if you read the book, and you could see where the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise pulled a lot of their ideas from Powers.
I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
I talked to my wife's ear off about that for about 3 days.
Yeah, it's crazy.
She has not read the book, and I don't think she's seen the fourth movie. So I was like having to describe in detail the book and the movie to her
right.
just to make these points that I was trying to make. And I'm sure she was like,
well, it's not even so just the fourth movie. It's all of them, you know, like they're yeah. all indebted to Powers. They just didn't have to pay him until they wanted to use the actual title of his book.
Right. I thought that fourth one, it was so interesting because you could really see how it just broke a lot of the plot by mm-hmm. trying to force Jack Sparrow into the cast.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
Yeah.
There was like no real room for Jack Sparrow in the cast. So they had to they had to change things to like allow Jack Sparrow to fit, and it really just started to unravel at that point.
Yeah, it did. I haven't seen any other movie after that one. That was it for me. I'm like, okay, I'm done. I did like that the Spanish showed up at the end, and they were like, only God is immortality, you know. And that was pretty awesome. Yeah, that was good. But yeah, Jack Sparrow, he just didn't fit in that movie at all. But yeah, it's the same with like the Bethesda games, like Fallout. You know, like they are completely indebted to pulp, you know, pulp stories, like The Shadow, you know, and these spy novels and all that stuff. Like they're completely indebted to written stories, you know. And it, like Skyrim is similar, you know. It's not as explicit in Skyrim, but like with all the stuff in Fallout, you know, it's like there's all this tongue-in-cheek stuff about, you know, this story, that story, this pulp culture thing, you know. And they those games wouldn't exist without the pre-existing story material, you know, or at least they wouldn't exist in the same form. So yeah, that's even though like men aren't reading as much, I think because partly because of video games and all that stuff, and I have nothing against video games, I like video games, but I also think partly it's because the market, you know, there's not a whole lot catering to young men, you know, as stories go. So that's why I thought your dedication was really interesting.
That's real. I mean it's easy to say, you know, it's an intractable problem, right? Like the video games, movies, there's just other things in the entertainment market that compete for eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. But at the same time, it's, you know, if you're trying to not see a conspiracy theory, it's not correct, right? Because there are a very small number of major publishers who are involved with putting books on bookshelves.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a very committed reader, you of course are going to look for things that you like and find specific authors and look for old things that have already been published and read what you want to read, right? You will find what you are looking for. But if you are like a normal guy, you go to the bookstore,
mm-hmm.
and you look at what's in the section on the shelf. And the person who decides what's on the section in the shelf is the person who can like show you, who limits your options, right? Who tells you what is within the like quote unquote law to read.
Right.
And those people are all leftoid New York white women whose husbands are very wealthy so that they can lose money on their crappy edit. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's literally a pet project for the wives of wealthy men.
Well, it's
so that they can make taste. Like they're just, you know, they're socialite tastemakers.
Well, it's crazy because they have so much power. They have so much power. Just putting stuff on the shelf, you know, to draw your attention to it. And they're basically like, I hardly ever go into a Barnes and Noble nowadays, because they just don't have anything I want. You know, I'll go to a used bookstore 100% of the time. You know, every time I find a used bookstore, I want to go because I don't know what I'm going to find. You know, it's kind of a fun adventure. But yeah, with like Barnes and Noble, and like, I think they're the only big bookstore left. I mean, there was Borders, but they've been gone for a long time. But where you go to the fantasy aisle and you see all these names I don't know, you know. You know, like, except for maybe like Larry Correa, maybe I see Larry Correa, maybe I'll see a Tim Powers on the shelf, maybe. But, and then maybe I'll find a Wolf or two, but mostly it's people that I don't know anything about, you know. I don't really have any interest in reading it. The covers are usually not very inspired, right? But the people who get to decide what sits on the shelf, they have a tremendous amount of power in the culture, you know. Like it's actually kind of crazy to think about, because that's like you said, it's like, this is what you're allowed to read. Not really, but not in actual fact. But like, you go to the official bookstore, you go to the official shelf, and this is what is okay for you to read. You know, that's, and luckily Amazon exists. I say luckily, Amazon's Amazon, but you have Amazon and you can find things on Amazon that you could not find, you know, in a standard bookstore. So that's good. But yeah, it's, you mentioned that, I'm like, wow, yeah, they do have a lot of power. That's a lot of influence to have over a culture, you know, to say
there's only there's only like five publishing companies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They have their divisions and they have their imprints. But it's a very small number of actual organizations that put out the vast majority of books that end up on bookshelves or bookstore bookshelves.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad stuff like this exists, like the stuff you're writing, because this is, it's not, there aren't a whole lot of stories like this out there. I mentioned Larry Correa. He's probably, you know, the main guy doing this sort of stuff. I know he just had a Twitter thread about his Son of the Black Sword series, which I haven't read yet. It's on my shelf. But he said that, oh, what did he say? It was about like trends in fiction. He's like, yeah, the trend I followed is like 70 years old, and it was from Robert E. Howard, you know? Because like,
So I read the first three of the stuff. One of the Black Sword series, and I think the fourth came out early this year, and I haven't gotten to it yet. And I reviewed them all for Bane on Twitter, and I really liked them, actually. I'm gonna not give them like a 10 out of 10.
Sure.
Larry Correa is, it's hard for me to like separate the man from the writing, and he's a very good writer. Like, I will never say that he's not a good writer. He's a very talented writer. He clearly like has, he has like, he's a professional. You know what I mean? He knows what he's doing, and it's consistently good. It's not like he's good on accident. And I respect that tremendously. And he sells a lot of books, and I respect that tremendously. But it's like, when I read it, I'm like, this is so Larry Correa. You know what I mean? With the Black Sword series, it's like, I can tell he's like just biding his time until the people in his setting can invent guns, and the people like his hero can invent guns and like own everybody else with his cool gun skills. Cause Larry Correa is like a big gun guy.
Right.
Yep. I was like, oh, Larry, I can see it coming, dude. I can see it in your head.
Yep.
I know you're going to do it. So
he's got a big personality, you know, and I think it's hard. I've read his blog a lot, you know, and I know people who know him, and I actually met him. Signed a couple books. Yeah, it was at the local bookstore burned down during the riots of 2020, and it was Uncle Hugo's. You know, it was really sad, and I was actually really ticked off. And other than, you know, obviously I was really angry that you know, Minneapolis was burning to the ground, but the fact that a bookstore, you know, like somebody purposely lit a bookstore on fire, you know, just because, I'm like, that really pissed me off. And it was a bookstore I really liked too. That also made it kind of personal. And so they reopened and they're fine now. But so they usually, when Larry Correa, usually when he puts out a new book, he'll go and he'll sign it at in St. Paul, you know, at the Uncle Hugo's, because they helped him get his start. I think they helped him publish his first book, I think, the owners. And so he goes back every time he's got a new book, and he promotes it, and he sells it out of their store, and they get a profit, you know, and it's, but this time it was at a Dreamhaven Books, which is kind of like their competitor, but also they're friendly. So they kind of were helping him out. So he was there and signing books, and, I was like, oh, what the hell? I'll go, you know. it's 20 minutes from me. I might as well go see Larry Correa. And I talked to him for, a couple minutes, and he signed a few books. He's a really nice guy. So, that's my claim to fame. Other than, you know, meeting other authors too, through the podcast.
What's my claim to fame? I was trying to think. Oh, I just got a new claim to fame. My only claim to fame. I've never really met like anybody famous, but the other day I did that Twitter space with John Eastman, who is Trump's lawyer. And as I was getting geared up to do that, I was like, this is by far like the most famous person that I've ever talked to in
my life. Wow.
And I didn't, you know, like I knew who he was before that, but as I was like researching it, I was like, oh damn, okay, this is like kind of a big deal actually. So that's my new claim to fame. I think before that my claim to fame was like meeting I met the band Nightwish back in like 2015 or 2005, kind of the Nightwish heyday, 2000 to 2005. So that was my claim to fame before John Eastman.
Yeah, well, that's crazy. That guy must have been in the news, because otherwise I would not have known who that was.
Yeah, it's been all over the news lately because he, I won't go into it, but California tried to take his law license away He was the guy who consulted with the Trump campaign on the whole thing about, you know, could Mike Pence refuse to, ratify the votes of the slates of electors sent by the states following the 2020 election. So he was kind of all the news stories were like, Trump's coup lawyer comes up with crazy fringe theory to coup the Constitution. And they had like all these like evil looking pictures of him. And they're like, this guy's like some constitutional professor somewhere, some con law professor somewhere.
yeah. It's like trying to overthrow the country.
Lawyers are not that cool. It's not suits. Please stop trying to make it like suits.
Yeah, we've gone over this every time. You know, you just say you're a lawyer and you move on. You impress all the ladies and just shut your mouth after that. Move on, you know.
Exactly.
So going back to your series, why is it called The Ashes of the Urn?
It's a little deep. It's a little deep lore from the series.
I
don't do a lot of world building. I'm not a big world builder.
It kind of comes up in your second book. There's some ash going on in that one.
You're right. Good eye. You picked up on it. And I'm doing more and more world building now because, the reason that I didn't do a lot of world building for the first one is because I didn't want that to ever slow me down or distract me from like finishing the story that I want to write.
Right.
But now that I kind of have that story and have that method down better, I feel more comfortable doing world building that will kind of, you know, fill out the story a little bit more and introduce some of the, you know, I mentioned Jack Vance's mechanisms. I want to do some of that too. Like, I want to have cool mechanisms and cool things going on in the story that my characters can interact with as part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Ashes of the Urn title and the idea specifically comes from this like local theological concept that the earth is like a funerary urn, and the people in it are like the cremated remains. Like it's a dead world, right? It's like an abandoned world. And it's like sort of a deist idea, but also sort of reflects some actual concepts loosely from Mesoamerican theology or cosmology, in which, you know, there are these successive worlds that mankind has kind of climbed through over the course of its existence and development. And I think some of them say that this is the fourth world now, right? And that the first through third worlds have, you know, decayed or become dead or whatever,
right,
so forth. But I'm just gonna, you know, I gotta pop the bubble a little bit and tell you there's not, you know, it's there. I know it's a good concept that may get developed further in the future, but there's not, you know, this is like a stage play. Okay. All the world building in my stuff, this is my philosophy on world building. There's enough that you enjoy the stage play, and I'm not going to do a bunch of other stuff to make it 3D that you're never going to see. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because then I would never get anything done. So
I think you're doing it right. I think the way, this is my personal preference, the way I like world building is it's as the story unfolds, you get more and more of it, right? Like that's what all the great authors do. Like Gene Wolfe does that, where it's like he kind of just throws you into it, right? You're just kind of thrown into this world and you kind of have to make sense of it as you go. And I really like that. And so just having little like hints here and there of like some broader, bigger thing in the background, you know, like I think in the second book you had this underground, like, what are they called? The ziggurats, you know, where they, this, you know, the sacrifices take place and stuff. And they, the heroes go, you know, into the earth and they find this, you know, super ancient ziggurat that's, you know, got all of the, you know, and they find this pile of ash, you know, and then and I'm like, okay, I think I'm getting something about the ashes here, because I'm like, because I'm like, I always got to think, okay, when I'm coming up with questions, you know, I'm like, okay, why is it called what you called it? Like, why is it called this? You know, and why are the characters named this way? And, you know, and I always find that that's what gets the most interesting answers. So those really basic questions, you know, people don't think to ask, you know, like they don't, right. They're like, okay, well, why, like, why did you have it? Why did you have this happen? This basic thing that nobody seemed to ask about, you know, like the turquoise serpent, you know, that's the first title, you know, like, what's that? You know, like, what's the why turquoise, you know, why a serpent? And if you read the first book, you know, you'll find out. Now, turquoise is interesting because you don't ever like describe why the serpent is turquoise. But when I did my episode on the Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe, you know, part of the research with that was like, okay, turquoise in Aztec culture was like the color of the gods, you know. And when Our Lady appeared on the Tilma, her mantle was turquoise, which indicates that she's from, you know, the heavenly realm. But she also didn't have a mask on, you know, which pagan gods usually would appear with a mask on to hide their divinity, or I'm not sure why, but they would that's what they would do. She didn't have a mask, you know, so she was human. So she's like this divine human, right? And so I know enough about, you know, Aztec mythology to kind of pick up on some things you put down, like the hummingbird in the second book, you know.
You got that one.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So, but instead of it being this pagan blood god, you know, it's kind of like leading the heroes to the mysterious woman who appears on Tepeya Hill. You know, I'm like, okay, I see what's going on here.
That's the easiest one.
Yeah, I'm like, it's cool though. Yeah. But the hummingbird is really important to Aztec cultures too, because their main god that led the Aztec people, they were nomadic, that led them to I forget where now, but to their main Tenochtitlan, I think. They were following the hummingbird god, you know, and I can't remember the name of the hummingbird god because all those names are really hard to pronounce. But so, yeah, that was interesting that you had the hummingbird kind of as the servant of the mysterious woman at the top of the hill, you know. So that was, and there's other hints like that too, that I always, that's what I like though when I'm reading stories. I don't need a ton of exposition, you know. I don't want a ton of like, and this is how this political system works, you know, let me spend two pages talking about this, right. You know, and I'm like, that's boring. I want to see it working. You know, I want to like,
right.
Like, oh, they're really, you know, it's really convoluted and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, okay, well, show me that, you know, like, and yeah. So you have this kind of, you have it how I like it, how you have the world building kind of as you go, you know, and in true pulp style, you know, it's like, you don't have too much planned out. You know, it's like, it's not like Tolkien where you set up this whole, you know, metaphysical system and then you build it off of that and like all this stuff, which is impressive and wonderful. And I love that too. But sometimes you just want, like Hellboy does this really well, you know, Mike Mignola, where Hellboy just goes on an adventure, you know, and it's like, yeah. And he fights, you know, he goes to Japan and he fights floating heads, you know, and, and it's,
that's
really cool. Yeah.
That's more or less exactly kind of what the sweet spot is here for me.
Where, yeah.
You know, eventually they're going to return to Batuun. They're going to return to their homeland and deal with the situation, you know, deal with their exile there.
Right.
But for the time being, I just want to write some like one shot ripping adventure stories.
Right.
And not be committed to this like constant build to an overall plot point across a Marvel number of, you know, interconnected stories.
Right.
And to do that in singular episodic stories gives me the leeway, I think, to kind of be really free with what I set up in each story. Right. So, you know, it's not like I have to incorporate the sun shark from Flowers of the Moon into anything else.
Right. Right.
I could just think up a cool monster and have a scene with that. And that's really nice to me, right? Like I just don't want to write the 800 word poem and have like my years and years of my quote unquote writing career sunk into that. And, you know, it has to sink or swim. Like, I just want to write some cool adventure stories, and I want to write like 50 of them,
right,
not necessarily all in this one series, but like, there's a lot of stuff I want to try. So, and I personally much prefer to read stories of around that length. I'm looking for the 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, you know, 150 pages to 300 pages is like the ideal novel length for me.
Right. Well, even Book of the New Sun, like each individual book is like 300 pages. It's not very long, you know, like I'll take it together. It's about 900, but that's pretty short, you know, like as far as a series goes. Even Lord of the Rings isn't that long. I mean, it's
no, that's what I think confuses a lot of people. Like, they think Lord of the Rings is this extremely long story, when in context, the entirety of the three books of Lord of the Rings, or three volumes of Lord of the Rings, is shorter than single volumes of other series that have like 8 or 9 books in them.
I know.
Right. Yeah. Like, if you're looking at some of the Game of Thrones books, if you're looking at some of Brandon Sanderson books, if you're looking at some of the Tad Williams books, mm-hmm. like Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, Green Angel Tower is like 1500 pages long. It's like one of the longest single fantasy books ever published. And it's much longer than the entirety of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think Lord of the Rings has this like strange reputation that kind of follows it around because nobody actually reads the books.
People are like, oh, it's long-winded and Tolkien talks too much about trees. And I remember one guy pointing out that actually, like, Tolkien's very economical in his word usage. Like, it's very tightly, it's very tight as a story. You know, it's.
I think that might have been me.
It might have been you. Yeah, it might have been.
I was looking at the index, right, with like the chapters and the page numbers, and I'm looking at it and I'm like, this part that everybody's mad about where they say it takes forever to like get the story started is like
a chapter,
25 pages or something. Like, it's like really not that long, and it's got like good stuff in it, you know?
Right.
So it's I don't know, the whole thing's crazy to me. Like, you can't find a page where he's talking about a tree for the whole page.
No.
People say it, but you just can't. That doesn't exist.
It's just like the stereotype of Tolkien, you know, that just isn't true. Like, he didn't waste any words, you know, like there's no wasted word in that series. It's a very tight and economical series. Like, you got tons of wasted words in most modern fantasy today. Like, I mean, I don't read a ton of newer, like the big doorstopper books. I mean, I like Christopher Rocchio a lot. He probably is the exception to my rule of like avoiding those giant series, because I mean, he's a Catholic and he's a very good writer. Like, he's very, very good and very entertaining. And so I've like really good books. But I'm like, I don't really want to read Brandon Sanderson, mostly because it's so friggin' long. Like, it's, they're like his Way of Kings. It's, I'm like, my buddy brought them over. He's like, here, I'm gonna let you borrow these. I'm like, I'm gonna be honest with you. Like, I'm not gonna read those. They're like, I have other things I want to read first, and I'm just not gonna get to these. And I liked Elantris because it was short, you know, it was like 300 pages.
That's my favorite one too.
Yeah,
that's
it's really good.
Everybody sleeps on that one and it's good.
And this is his first one, his first book. And I'm like, this is really good. Right. This is it's very entertaining, and there's a lot of, a lot of good things to chew on in here, and the characters are all good. It kind of turns into something pretty goofy by the end, but it was fun, you know. I liked it, and it's the shortest one. So
that's why you always see me posting. I'm always mad about the Patrick Rothfuss books, because those are like it's like they're the worst of the worst in terms of like word count to content ratio.
Right. It's
truly nothing happening in those books, and there's so many words long.
You're like, I'm just wasting my time reading this. And so that's why I like the shorter, punchier stories. I mean, I like the meatier books too, you know. Like, obviously, I like Teen Wolf, and but his like Wizard Knight's pretty long, you know. But that's everything else is pretty tight, you know. It's not, they're not very long books. I mean, they can feel long because they're hard to get through sometimes. But
right.
But yeah, I like those, the pulp style sort of like, and that's not something you get much anymore, you know. Like you don't, there aren't any like mainstream authors, with the exception of maybe Larry Correa, who can kind of punch out like, you know, these shorter, just action-packed, you know, pulp style books. Especially like, I mean, those are pretty long compared to like what Robert E. Howard was doing, you know. It was pretty short. Like he, like it's basically short fiction to novellas. Like that's what he was kind of writing most of it.
Right.
And you don't really, there aren't really many venues for that, and they're hard, like any, and whatever venues there are fewer readers. So because it's all like online magazines, and like most, especially men, like we were saying, like most men don't read, and if they do read, they're going to read the stuff that's on the shelf at Barnes and Noble and not like on this weird magazine online, you know.
Yeah, or there's like, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but you know, there's like the category of people who go on, you know, fan fiction sites like Royal Road or Wattpad, and they read like weird fetish stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like weird monster girl harem stories.
Yep. I don't recommend doing that. Go to confession if you do that.
You know, it exists, unfortunately.
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah, go to confession, people, if you're doing that. Don't read that stuff. Read other things. you have in your story, you have Caillou Kali, who's the warrior. He's kind of this grizzled warrior who he's seen some stuff and done some things. And he's probably my favorite character, just because he's so, I don't know, calm, but also he's very Conan-like in that he distrusts the gods. You know, he does, well, for good reason. Like the gods are, they're no good, man. They chew you up and spit you out. And then you have Tezca, who is the boy wizard, who's not really, he's kind of a young adult. And then you have the female character, Zok, is that how you pronounce it?
Shok.
What was that?
The Shok.
Shok. Okay. Shok.
X H. It's basically the S H. Okay. Right? Shok. The X is like an S H.
Okay. Gotcha. So they're like the three main characters, and they're all fleshed out, and they are all very, you know, they're all distinct characters, right? They all have their own personalities and they own the quirks and stuff, which is fun. So. What I want to know with, I know a lot of, you know, yeah, like sensitivity readers and stuff like that now, and people making sure that no one is triggered by anything that they read or whatever. I obviously I was not reading this. But with Shok, she is a female character, you know, and she's a very well drawn female character. And, How do you write female characters? Like, how do you personally do that? Because you have a few of them in your books, and I know that's kind of a hot button thing where people are like, oh, a man can't write female characters, and you can't write anything that's not like your very specific demographic, which I think is bunch of bull crap. But she's got the feminine characteristics, and she's very heroic and brave, you know. And how do you go about like writing a female character?
It's a tricky question. Because I never really put a lot of thought into that specifically, writing a female character versus a male character, except that I did make one conscious decision for myself in this series, that I wasn't going to write any female characters like doing a lot of fighting.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
Because I just,
which is controversial enough, you know, not in like for
it's
most
controversial enough.
Yeah. Most media.
That kind of goes back to what the original goal was with this, which was to be just controversial enough, right? that it wasn't actually, like, I'm not trying to be a right-wing author.
Right, so no. And I got like, no indication of that when you read this. Like, it's a well-told story, which is what you want, you know? And, yes. Yeah, so go ahead, sorry.
But I did want, if, like, somebody who were, let's say, a sensitivity reader or a sensitivity reader type person read it I wanted them to be like, why am I mad? You know, why am I upset about this book? Just right. Like that little bit of controversy. And so, you know, the decision to not have like a, you know, a badass female warrior or whatever is part of that. And that's not to say that can't ever work. For example, I just posted about and read the Mongoose and Meerkat stories, which are published by Kursowa magazine,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Written by Brave, and they're awesome. They're really, really good. It's one of the best things I've seen come out of the indie scene, at least our indie scene. And if you know, it features a female, like, kind of roguish warrior in them, and it really doesn't bother me. I think it's handled really well. I like the character; it's great. But in my book, I was just like, I'm just not going to do that because, you know, that's, you know, the tone of that book is different than the tone of my book, and I don't think it would work for my book at all, and I don't want to do it. So that kind of limited what I could do with female characters since I was looking at it. And then I was thinking, what are just some like classic female archetypes? You know what I mean? So with Shoke, it was kind of easy because I was like, okay, well, I got the wizard, I got the warrior. I'm working in a pulp setting here, a sword and sorcery pulp setting. I can pull from these like classic archetypes, and you can think of them as, you know, Dungeons and Dragons classes even. I was like, where's my healer?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So shook on some of that aspect, and also some like characteristics from my sister in a way, where I knew that because there was so much conflict between Kayakali and Teska, and they're both such like, you know, characters that are both under stress from their circumstances and in conflict with each other interpersonally, I was like, we need some kind of like counterbalance to that. So with Shoke, it was like easy to write her as being sort of not easily offended, and not like overly aggressive, right? Like she's like, you know, circumstances are bad for her at a certain point in the story, but in general, like her character is that she's a pretty pleasant and upbeat person. And I often feel like, you know, writers make the mistake of not including like a spectrum of character traits in their characters, in their story, especially with secondary characters, which are just such a great, they present such a great opportunity to play with contrasting characters to whatever your protagonists and even your villains are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Shoke was definitely that. And then, you know, when we get to the second story, and we have Lady Six Sky, that was sort of the same logic, right? I was like, okay, well, there's the classic, like, influential woman at court, right? The string puller at court, the grand dame, the matriarch, witch, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very easy to make, to like let Six Sky fall into that pattern. And it kind of came out of the historical research that I was doing when I was like kind of thinking about these early Mayan civilizations. And, you know, there are a few occasions where they do come to be ruled by like a powerful queen regent or the sister of a king who's like a weak king or something like that. And so, you know, you do have that archetype exists in reality. And yeah, everybody knows that archetype exists in reality, right? Like everybody knows that there are circumstances, whether it's on the household level or on the corporate level or in governmental levels, where, you know, some woman who is not necessarily in charge of things is in fact in charge of things.
Right.
Or at least trying to be, right? Scheming to be. And so with Six Guy, I think the fun part was, it was giving her the sort of rabid traditionalist view.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
because she's kind of the one who is like most committed to adherence to like the classic,
the old ways.
You know, the local old ways. And so that was really cool. Like it was a fun way because like, you know, I have that impulse exists within me, obviously.
Sure. Yep.
In certain ways. So it was like fun to give her, cause I always like to give villains, like the villain should have a, like a good, like a decent point at least. Right. It's like, in some way, you know, and sometimes you can just have like a Joker type evil villain, but you know, often they pick the Joker his own decent point. But with Six Guy, it was like a lot of fun to kind of do that. And then, you know, one thing that I felt like I didn't do really well in that was I was trying to kind of like, I was trying to kind of build a relationship, an early relationship between her and Kai Kali based on their like mutual kind of maturity over, you know, the ages of characters like Tesca and Shoak, and in that one, Netsa Quiatl. And so, you know, who are like kind of the younger characters. And then I was trying to have Kai Kali be like more on a level with, of understanding with Six Guy, and Six Guy have, you know, some minor attraction to him or that kind of thing, or fake attraction that she was trying to use to manipulate him, that kind of thing. But I, you know, I'm not, I think if I were to rewrite it, I would either cut that or try to develop it more, because I think it just kind of sat in that gray area where it's not, you know, it's there, but it's not enough.
With Lady Six Guy, is there something going on with that name? I'm always fixated on names in fantasy stories, because like six is like, it's like the perfection in the garden, but it's like man's perfection or something like that. And then it has all this association with the demonic, you know, with the number of the beast and stuff. And I'm wondering, you know, and you have stuff like human sacrifice. We can get to the human sacrifice, but like in human sacrifice parts the veil between our world and the realm of the gods, and like that's kind of like the sky, you know. So I'm like, is there something going on with her name that would indicate kind of her trajectory as a character, you know? And it does turn out that she is indeed a witch and is killing people to, I mean, spoilers, this is all spoilers, so she you know, she's doing all sorts of bad stuff and, you know, trying to get the favor of the demon gods that she works for. So is there anything going on with that? Am I onto something with her name?
Yeah, well, there's actually a lot going on with that. Certainly the presence of six in that was pleasing to me. Like, I definitely thought about that, and I was like, it informed my decision. But at the same time, I have personally just always had this weird fascination with the word six specifically. I don't care about the number. I just like the word for whatever reason. And so, you know, like if you, like that, it features in like a lot of my, you know, in a lot of my passwords or usernames or that kind of thing, because I just like it. And so, you know, when it popped up in my research, there is actually a historical Lady Six Guy. I just ripped it straight out of history.
Wow. Book.
And I think it's one of the only ones that I didn't at least slightly change.
Right.
I can't think of any others that I didn't at least slightly change. But yeah, that one I just ripped straight out of history. Although, of course, in like ancient Maya, it's not six, it's a translation.
Sure.
Of sort of like a portion of what her full name probably was. But because that stelae is so degraded, they argue about what the full name actually is.
Mm.
In literature, she's referred to that way. So, so there was like just a lot of confluences of thinking and interests and lines of play that where I was like, yep, that's the one. I like that one. I just like how it sounds. And I don't spend like a ton of time agonizing about the names either. I'll usually just find something that I think is cool or sounds cool. Bonus points if it's thematically connected.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a thematic connection between what it is going to be in the story and what it is, you know, where it's coming from in the course of my research, then I'll change it. A lot of them I change around so that they read more easily, frankly. Like, as messed up as some of these names read and sound, they are edited to be more like pronounceable and cognizable than they actually are in ancient Nahuatl, right, in the ancient Aztec languages, because that is a, you know, it's a tricky language, man.
Yeah.
It's tricky.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's interesting. I liked her character quite a bit, as a villain, and I did like that she was also a traditionalist. You know, it was really, really interesting. I was like, okay, yeah, they're a bad, because I can, you know, I'm a traditional sort of Catholic and stuff. I prefer the older mass, and I'm like, okay, yeah, there are, you know, there are bad ways to be a traditionalist, you know, like if your tradition is, you know, human sacrifice and pagan gods, then yeah, that's, so I want to also talk about, I think this is also a part of, Aztec, maybe it was Mayan, history, but you have a couple characters in here. You have Netzka and, his uncle, who is the speaker for the gods, as a Quelpa, and they both, like, to Lady Six Guy, they're heretics because they believe they want to worship the true God, you know, but they don't really know how, right? Because they only have like visions and dreams where they kind of intuit it, you know. But I think in Mayan history there actually was a king who didn't he like secretly worship like the high god, like something like that. I can't remember what his name was, but is that from history as well, that concept?
It is, yeah. And that is, I think, very interesting that you picked up on that, because that's not like surface history either. It's pretty obscure stuff. And in fact, it wasn't even a secret, it was pretty open. I mean, he built like a substantial temple to his, you know, his kind of like unknown god or whatever.
Right.
And the interesting thing to me, obviously, as similarly to you in terms of being a Catholic and a traditionally inclined Catholic, mm-hmm. is the characteristics of that god are very, very, you know, to me, they read as like a prefigurement or an intuition of the nature of God, right?
Right.
Where he's not requiring human sacrifice from the Aztecs in the same way that the local deities are. And that he has this like all pervasive, omnipresent nature. Some of the aspects of how that king, that speaker, in fact, as the title actually translates, ordained or ordered that worship are very, you know, familiar or would be familiar to us. And it's imperfect, of course. Like there were, you know, in that temple, there were also shrines to the local deities and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's not like he forbade everybody else from worshiping those or continuing human sacrifices or anything. But the fact that, in such a society so completely governed by such wicked spirits, that happened at all is, I think, really compelling to me.
Yeah.
And that the character of Netzahualcoyotl in this story is, that name came, if I recall correctly, that name came from that historical king who had that intuition and built that temple. So
yeah,
that's kind of like, you can see my thinking on that.
Right. Right. Well, if I remember correctly, that historical king also didn't forbid the worship of the local gods or anything like that. But he did, I think he told his sons, you know, like he basically was like, yeah, I don't believe in worshiping those gods anymore. You know, something like that, where he's like monotheistic in a sense. Right. I mean, cause like it's a tricky topic, but like I'm monotheistic in the sense that I worship the high god who created all the other small g gods. Right. And I also think the gods exist, but they're demons. Right. So it's like,
all right.
You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, I'm monotheistic, but it's not like I don't believe in these evil spirits, right? Or good spirits, if they're angels, you know, whatever. But so it's like, monotheism is like a term that's loaded with a lot of stuff I don't like. It's not like, it's not accurate enough as a term. But as far as it goes, it's like, yes, this king was monotheistic in the sense that he worshipped only the high god, you know, or he wanted to anyway. He didn't know how, but...
Right, or he considered that god to be like... You know, there's a linguistic, like you said, small g versus big g.
Right.
Distinction, and you consider that god to be of a higher order.
Right. You know? Yeah. Orders of magnitude higher than the other ones. Yeah. It's really, that sort of stuff is very interesting to me too, because I'm like, okay, like God is always working in these, even these like horrific cultures, you know, and our culture now, you know, is we're better at hiding it. Right. But there's pretty horrific things in our culture too, as far as human sacrifice goes. We call it other things, you know, but it's hidden and it's under, you know, I think it's, you know, Pope, one of the best things Pope Francis ever said was, calling, abortionist hitmen, you know, and like they hitmen with white gloves on, you know, or something like that. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty accurate. You know, it's, they put on, you know, all the fan, you know, unless they're Gosnell or whatever that guy's name was, the actual serial killer.
Oh, yeah, Kermit Gosnell.
Yeah, yeah, whose facility was so disgusting, you know, like, but what he was doing wasn't categorically different than what other abortionists were doing. He was just kind of embracing it more as a serial killer.
Yeah, the other ones just have better marketing schemes.
Like, right, and they're cleaner facilities a lot of the time. Not even all the time. Like, some of those facilities are pretty gross. But anyway, so like this theme of like human sacrifice and like that's what these demonic beings want. And not every pagan culture, you know, had it as explicitly as like the Aztecs. Not even close. But they all had it on some level, you know. You know, you had, I think it was in the Romans, you'd have like virgins buried alive with, you know, to consecrate a temple or something like that. Maybe I'm misremembering, but it's something like that, where it's like they kind of don't like human sacrifice, but they're also like willing to just, you know, okay, well, we'll just bury slaves alive in, right, you know, and like, but we don't want to get our hands dirty, so we'll let the lack of oxygen, you know, take care of them for us. But with human sacrifice, like, that's like big themes in your books, and how it, like, society is structured around that, especially in the first book, with Calakmul, the serpent culture, you know. And basically their whole lineage of kings is like a thrall to the turquoise serpent, where the new king has to be, you know, the old king is executed, sacrificed, and then the new king is like basically possessed eventually by the snake god. But that's all of their whole like system of like of government and like their whole culture is based around that concept. And you wrote a whole essay on Robert E. Howard's Conan that kind of touches on that too, and kind of it's like an apologia of Conan the stories, because it's not something that like Robert E. Howard is not something that like Catholics read. You know what I mean? Right. It's you usually have like the Frank Frazetta covers, which they're pretty salacious, you know, and that's enough to turn, you know, pious Catholics off, which I understand. Right. But the story, like, you know, you can't really understand fantasy as a genre without at least knowing and acknowledging Robert E. Howard. Cause he and Lovecraft and like Clark Ashton Smith, Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, all those guys, those pulp authors, like American fantasy wouldn't be what it is if they weren't around. And Tolkien apparently even read a Robert E. Howard Conan story and liked it.
Yep. Yep.
Sure. He, of all the American science fiction and fantasy stories that he was given, I think by, was it?
L. Sprague de Camp.
Yeah, L. Sprague de Camp. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. I think Conan was one of the only ones he actually liked.
Yeah,
which should tell you that the stories are well written, you know. And so tell us kind of about like your essay about Conan and how like human sacrifice kind of ties in to Conan and to your stories.
Yeah, the essay about Conan started kind of as this idea to defend the quality specifically of Howard's writing, right? The cultural importance of his career. And that came out of some discussion that was going around on Twitter, just, you know, between people in my circle who were saying, essentially, look, I see how Clark Ashton Smith is, you know, philosophically thematically, idea wise, important. I see, of course, how H.P. Lovecraft is philosophically, thematically, idea wise, important. But people always talk about Howard, you know, as part of, you know, a writer like those two guys, like those other two guys, H.P. Lovecraft especially.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see it. This guy was saying, I don't see what's so great about Howard. How is he important? So, you know, the idea was just like, oh, I think I have, you know, I can argue why Howard's important. I have a take on that. So I wrote this essay, and the basis of the essay is to point out that Howard's entire body of work for Conan takes place in the early, early prehistory of our world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've done some timeline calculation. Of course, there's no real answer as to when it takes place chronologically. But in one of the intros to one of the stories, Howard says it takes place between the fall of Atlantis and the Aryan invasion. So, you know, sometime before, like, sometime like 10 to 12,000 years ago, maybe, depends on when you think Atlantis fell.
Right.
Or when you think Howard thought Atlantis fell. But, so we're in prehistory, right? And the world of that prehistory is not what people commonly think of when they think of Conan the Barbarian, which I think is almost like a caveman, right? Like he's a caveman type barbarian, mm-hmm, in fur loincloth with a big club, and he just bashes people and he can barely talk. That's not Conan the Barbarian.
No,
right?
No.
Conan the Barbarian is in a highly, highly civilized world, much more civilized than anything up to, you know, before maybe like the Roman Empire, right? Like Aquilonia, Brythunia, Koth, all these kingdoms in the Hyborian Age of Conan are like on par with Egypt at its pinnacle, Rome at its pinnacle, the Medes at their pinnacle, the Persian, all that. China, if you go far enough east to Kitai, which is his China parallel. And so we have this highly, highly civilized world that is in fact failing specifically because it is so civilized,
mm-hmm,
right? It's grown stale, morbid, stultifying, unable to kind of live under the weight of itself, under its weak kings, under its eunuch classes of bureaucrats and administrators, all this. And that is specifically and explicitly a mirror to our world. Right? A mirror to today.
Yeah.
Or you know, where Robert Howard in the late 1920s, early 1930s saw us going. And so not only is there this critique, this like really, really perceptive and well-written critique of trends in the modern world, there's also his solution, right? And his solution is the Conan character. And so as you read the Conan stories, you see how Howard thinks that you should essentially, how a real blood in his veins, living man can make his way through a world that is like not designed for that, right? That is essentially a machine built around producing evil. And that's where we get back to the Aztec stuff, because this is another like a misconception that a lot of people have about the Aztecs, where you always see this argument, you know, online where, oh, the conquistadors conquered they colonized the Aztecs, they're so, Cortez was so terrible, blah, blah, blah. Or now you get the reaction on our side of Twitter, who are all like, yeah, the Spaniards wasted the Aztecs, stupid Aztecs, they suck. And, you know, neither side of this is like really thinking it through or knows anything about the situation, because Aztecs were, you know, Cortez's involvement in the fall of the Aztec Empire is fascinating and, you know, daring and heroic, of course. But it was also, Cortez was a wedge, a political wedge used by enemies of the Mexica tribe, which made up part of the Triple Alliance that constitutes the head of the Aztec Empire, mm-hmm, right? There's a civil war brewing, because of how the Mexica are treating the Tlaxcalans and other tribes with kind of lower stakes, like lesser levels of importance within the Aztec Empire, and the volume of human sacrifice and other tribute that they are demanding from these tribes who are either in the alliance with them, ruling the empire, or subject to the empire.
Right.
So a lot of people do not like the Mexica in Tenochtitlan. And so Cortez comes in, almost dies in Tenochtitlan, escapes by the skin of his teeth on the Noche de Triste, on the Night of Tears, gets back to, I think, Tlaxcala, and essentially says, hey, we'll help, like, let's do it. Let's overthrow them. Let's overthrow the Mexica, and I've got, you know, the Spanish Empire backup coming. And the other tribes are like, yeah, let's do it. Screw these guys. We hate these guys, you know? So it's not like it's just Cortez, right?
No.
It's Cortez and like tens and hundreds of thousands of people that are starting a civil war.
Right.
And so certainly he played like a critical, crucial part in it. But at the same time, like there's a very refined, well-developed, politically sophisticated society here that where this is all taking place. And that society is like a machine that just chews through human sacrifices. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, they argue about the numbers, but it's certainly tens of thousands a year, at least, you know, up to 100,000 a year, which is a huge number of people.
It's, yeah.
You know, this is like 1300, 1400 AD. Like that's, you know, now because there's 7 billion people on Earth, you think that's nothing, but there was like a billion people on Earth at the time, maybe.
Right.
And not that many in the Aztec Empire. Like it's not a, you know, it's a big empire. It's one of the biggest. Tenochtitlan at its height is probably one of the biggest cities on Earth, like Rome or London. But even the biggest city on Earth at that time is not that big. So they're really wasting like a lot of people from the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And so in all of this, like all these parallels, the actual facts of the ancient Aztecs, Robert Howard's Hyborian era, these things are connected deeply to today. And Howard's point is that this is just a cycle that happens, right? Like this is civilizations get over civilized in this way, and they start to do these things, right? You start to have these like cults. You know, you'd think it's because it's civilized there wouldn't be cults, but in a sense, there's more cults because it is over civilized, and you have the infrastructure that you need to conduct these human sacrifices. It's not that. How do you get 100,000 people from all over the Valley of Mexico and the environment around it into Tenochtitlan and keep them, you know, that's a lot of people to just be managing.
Right.
And to get them up the pyramid and cut their heart out and do all the things that, you know, there's somebody that's got to clean up the blood. There's somebody that's got to do the chopping. You've got to have five guys, one on each limb to stretch them over the sacrificial altar. And then the fifth guy who's like trained to do the cutting the right way and do the ritual the right way.
Yeah.
There's a school for these guys.
Right.
Right. These guys go to school for this. There's like all these institutional structures.
They literally had schools for the warrior, especially for like their warrior classes. They had like,
right.
I think in my episode on Our Lady of Guadalupe, I think I said, or maybe the guest said it was like Hogwarts, like evil Hogwarts or something like that.
Yes. Right.
It's like, yeah, they had wizard school, but instead of learning how to levitate things, they cut out your heart.
Right. And so, you know, and those schools have teachers, those schools have their own, you know, people involved with them. And so, when you are
vast bureaucracies and all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
The connections ramify through society. And then almost everybody is implicit in this, right? They're connected to the act. And so they, it becomes very difficult to excise it, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'll give you a perfect example. I have a friend who's married to a woman whose sister is gay,
mm-hmm.
right? And so my friend's a good Catholic boy. His wife is a good Catholic girl. Her sister is like super gay, super leftoid, vegan, the whole thing, really, you know, really committed to it, such that not only is she gay married to another woman, but they have 4 test tube babies together that they got from a donor.
Wow.
How do you come back from that?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
How do you say at that point, like, okay, we're going to unwind this marriage. We're going to dissolve this whole situation. Like, this has all been a lie. You know, this has all been a sin that we've committed. How do you deal with that? That's like so much to unravel of like the way that you've built your life, everybody, all your friends, all your family, everything around you. So then it becomes even difficult for her sister and my friend who's married to the, you know, and now they're connected to this, and they have, you know, their life is complicated by this because, you know, either that connection gets severed or, you know, where do you draw the line? Like, when are you complicit in not calling that out or not, you know, what are you supposed to do in that situation? It gets very thorny because of those connections and the way that like connections to the evil act just like ramify through society.
Yeah.
So in Conan, the point of the essay is that when you read between the lines in Conan, there's all these, you know, temple maidens and virgin sacrifices and cult actions going on. And all of that requires a ton of infrastructure. And so all of society in Conan is implicated in this. And it takes somebody who is from outside of that society to kind of cut that Gordian knot.
Yeah.
And that's the Conan character, right? He's a barbarian. He's from the fringes of society. He has this like vital energy where he comes in and says, "Hey, I don't care." You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. I wonder,
to me.
Like, I wonder how much Conan is based off of Hernan Cortez, because Cortez is very much a Conan sort of, I should maybe say Conan is very much a Cortez sort of character, because, you know, he's an outsider. He comes in, and actually Cortez, the Spaniards, fulfilled a prophecy that that the Aztecs had, you know, about the white god with a beard coming from the east and ending the world, you know, and that's exactly what happened. Cortez even has his like concubine, you know, like that. And this not quite perfect guy, you know, far from perfect,
Interesting that you say that in. Because I think one of the little known like trivia pieces about Conan is that Howard, Howard is from Texas, of course, Crosspoint, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point he goes on a road trip with a buddy of his, I think through New Mexico and maybe into Arizona. I'm not sure about the Arizona part of that, but certainly he ends up like basically on the Rio Grande River looking into Mexico and then goes into Mexico. And there's a quote from a letter of his specifically where he's saying like, that's when he conceives of the Conan character.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So it's like right on the border or in Mexico that he's, you know, it's certainly North Mexico, right? It's not like Mexico City where all the Aztec stuff was really taking place, but
right.
I just think I find it very interesting that, he himself actually, his final published Conan story was Red Nails.
Mm.
And if you know Red Nails, that story is Howard starting to incorporate some Aztec stuff into the Conan mythos, right?
And
so that's like, that's one of my favorite Conan stories, and that's a big influence to me because it's not just Aztec stuff. He's kind of like mixing Aztec stuff with like Hopi stuff that he sees in New Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
He's talking about the pueblos in New Mexico, and the city that they wind up in Red Nails is, if you like read the description, it sounds a lot like a pueblo that you'd see in New Mexico.
Yeah.
I need to
read more Conan. I mean, I've read a little bit, but like that essay was like, okay, yeah, I need to get cracking on this. Because he like when Gene Wolfe, when Robert E. Howard is like Gene, one of Gene Wolfe's after Tolkien, one of his like favorite authors, you know that there's something there, you know, there's something in Robert E. Howard that is probably going to be timeless, you know, and there's a depth there, you know, that you'll miss, you know, if you're just focused on the Frank Frazetta covers and, you know, the smashing giant monsters with swords and stuff, which is great. You know, I love fighting giant monsters with swords. Like, that's awesome. But like, there's just a lot of depth there, that people I think miss. They'll get like, oh, he's, Robert E. Howard is anti-civilization. And it's like, well, probably not. I mean, he lived in a civilization, you know, I'm sure it's more complicated than that. Where like Conan's king, not, right? Yeah, Conan becomes the king, right? And he, and Conan is not this uncivilized brute. He's very intelligent. He's very cunning, clothes. And
he likes to wear clothes.
Yeah, they right.
Clothes, not a caveman.
Right. Yeah, I think people get the like the from the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. You know,
right.
Like when Arnold Schwarzenegger couldn't even really speak English. You know, he had to memorize his lines. That was like the first English he learned, I think, was like memorizing the Conan lines. And he, you know, that movie isn't really Conan, but I remember a priest in a homily once, who generally I like, and he said, you know, he's talking about masculinity and what it means to be a man. And he's like, it's, you can't just go around and just be like Conan the Barbarian. And I'm like, well, we have to at least be a little bit like Conan the Barbarian. We can't stop there. Right. Right. But yeah. You have to make, I think a little bit of Conan is probably what's needed, I think.
I don't know if I included it in this essay or if I just posted it on Twitter somewhere, but I have this theory. Right, or I don't know if it's a theory, but it's my analysis. I think that what Howard is doing with Conan is because he's very aware, Howard is very aware, that the setting that he's writing in is a pre-Christian setting.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a antediluvian world.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes through when, for example, in the story A Witch Shall Be Born, Conan actually gets crucified. Right. And mm-hmm. the way that plays out is like, you can't help but compare it and contrast it to the crucifixion and think about it in that, you know, in that context. And then there are other elements of that as well. Right. The way he talks about the god Maitra or Mitra in some of the stories is really interesting. Some of his philosophies are interesting when you're considering the stories in this pre-Christian setting. But I think one of the most interesting things about it to me is the way that Howard is like really trying to get the sum total of pre-Christian virtue into one person.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we see, you know, Conan is like, he's like Achilles plus Hector plus Odysseus, right? He's all of them.
Yeah. Yep.
But what he doesn't have is Christian virtue.
Right.
Right, or if he does, it's like very rudimentary and undeveloped because it's a pre-Christian setting. And so I think that's, you know, I think that is the limitation of the character. So to the extent that I'm saying all this to agree with you. I think it's good to be, you know, it is good to be a little bit like Conan, but you have to also go beyond that and acknowledge that, you know, we're not in a pre-Christian setting anymore.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, we have to at least be like at the bare minimum like Conan. Right? Where it's right. Like somebody, I think it was I had him on the show, Ben Espen. I think on Twitter, like he, maybe it was him, maybe it was you. I don't know. I feel like every time I say this, I saw it on Twitter, it was probably you. But like what it means to be a man is basically like Solomon Cain mixed with Conan. You know, the, like what women want in a man is like the virtue and chastity of Solomon Cain and the ferocity of Conan. You know? And I'm like, that's a really interesting way to think about that. Cause like, those are two very different characters. And they're both very like, I mean, obviously Solomon Cain is Puritan, you're right. And he's a Christian and Conan is very much pagan, but you put them together, you know, and you get something resembling maybe like the funhouse mirror of Catholicism. I don't know. it's a weird thing to think about, but I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you know, you have the virtue and stalwart faith of Solomon Kane, and the ferocity and cunning of Conan. But yeah, that essay was great. And, I think we got to wrap it up here. Cause it's right now it's getting pretty late for me, but again, I've been up every night later than this, putting stuff away and packing. So I'm like, my wife's like, yeah, you've trained for this. Like you've been training, training yourself for this moment.
I go the other direction, get some sleep. No, I know. Advantage of it.
Well, I got one more question for you. And if you've listened to the show, you probably know what's coming. So this is, the show's called I Might Believe in Fairies. And, every day I become more and more convinced that there's something to what fairies are, you know, there's something to it. And, but it's, I might believe in fairies. So I want to ask you, Alexander, do you believe in fairies?
I might. No, I think I do. I believe in like fairies broadly.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I believe in the possibility of fairies, even if I don't have a good model for theoretically what they would be. I had a friend, one of my earliest friends on Twitter was this like lunatic Brazilian guy named Ludo, who had like, he had some like crazy theory about fairies where he thought that they were like demons who forgot that they were being punished. Like he thought that they like basically had gone insane and just kind of like forgot about the whole situation and were, you know,
wow.
Obviously I don't remember that. And I don't know that he had any basis for believing that whatsoever. And it's also very possible that there were translation errors because his English was not that good.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But, my point, I guess, is that I don't have any particular theory about what fairies are, but on balance, it seems like a lot of people, like, you know what I mean? Like, I kind of can triangulate off other people who everybody says that they exist, and it seems like, you know, there's some basis to think that they exist. So, you know, if you pressed me, I would say, yeah, I do. But the truth is, I might.
Fair enough, man. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.